dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the dark.
You're listening to episode 630 of Unwelcome Guests, The Sixth Mass Extinction. I'm Robin Upton. And for a change of pace this week, we've looked a lot at money and debt in recent months, trying to clarify the system which would lock most of humanity in an existential struggle about this fictional thing called money, which sometimes seems so important, especially to economists and to commentators on the commercially controlled media. Instead of fictional world, we're looking at the real world. How is life on Earth? How are the plants and animals with which we share this planet? How are they faring under this relentless pressure of neoliberal globalization? Unused to the demands of the system to justify themselves in money terms, what's happening to population levels, to species diversity? That's the focus of our first film this week, which features mostly academics and one or two familiar voices to the show, such as Derek Jensen. The film is called Call of Life, Facing the Mass Extinction, and it's from 2011.
There's a mass extinction occurring on the planet today.
We may well lose half of the world's biological diversity.
The most dire numbers, I think, are on the timescale of about 35 years.
Do we know enough about what's going on to be scared by it? My answer as a scientist is hell yes.
I don't think we in any way should feel complacent that we are not on the list of possible extinctions.
Natural systems that have been stable for millions of years are in turmoil. Plant and animal populations are rapidly declining, and species are becoming extinct faster than ever before. Scientists have begun to call this a mass extinction event.
Gretchen Daly, director of the Tropical Research Program, Stanford University.
Extinction happens, that's a fact. Something like 95% or more of all the life forms that have lived on Earth went extinct naturally. The difference today is that the rate of extinction vastly exceeds the rate of evolution of new species. So over time, we've typically had the situation where more species were evolving into being than were going extinct. Today, we're having a dramatic cutback in what's out there.
Stuart Pym, Professor of Conservation Ecology, Duke University.
The natural rate of extinction is about one in a million. By that, I mean that in a year, the natural geological background rate of extinction should involve one species in a million going extinct.
Norman Myers, Professor of Environmental Science, Oxford University.
Today, we estimate that there could be several dozen species effectively going extinct every day The extinction rate now is at least 100 times and maybe 1,000 times, conceivably 10,000 times, greater than it has been in the prehistoric past.
It's like looking out at a beach and seeing that it's disappearing. You don't need to have identified and put a name to every grain of sand out there, much less counted all those grains of sand, to see very clearly that they're disappearing.
Ignacio Capella, Associate Professor of Microbial Ecology, University of California, Berkeley.
There has never been anything like this in human history. You know, humans have never seen anything like this. The only precedents we have are really catastrophic declines in the geological past.
Peter Rupnarine, Curator of Invertebrate Zoology and Geology, the California Academy of Sciences.
We've documented 5 mass extinctions, we call them the 5 big ones, in the geological record over the last 500 million years. And these are quite dramatic events.
Richard Leakey, anthropologist and author of The Sixth Extinction.
65 million years ago, an asteroid is believed to have hit the planet somewhere near the Gulf of Mexico, and the result of that impact was the destruction of systems that supported life all over the world. The dinosaurs disappeared. Many, many other species disappeared at the same time. It was something like an 80-85% loss of life.
I would consider that this mass extinction issue is surely a greater crisis, impending disaster, than terrorism or even a nuclear exchange, and I'm choosing my words here very carefully. In many ways, it's the biggest crisis since we came out of our caves 10,000 years ago, no less.
Land animals, down 28% since 1970. Marine birds, down 30% since 1995. Big ocean fish, down 90% since 1950. Freshwater fish, down 50% since 1987. Marine animals, down 28% since 1970.
I think at this point, it's very hard to find anybody within the scientific community who would not agree that we're going through a very catastrophic, dramatic loss in diversity right now.
Songbirds, down 50% since 1965.
The scientific community is quite confident. There's consensus in estimates of the magnitude of the extinction episode we're in today.
Peter Vitusek, Professor of Biological Sciences, Stanford University.
I think our estimates of how many will be lost if we're on this path are pretty good, and they're really big numbers. I mean, they're more than half of the species on the land surface.
There's a lot of things that are going to happen within a generation, within 30 to 40 years from now. And many of those things that are going to happen are completely irreversible. Extinction is forever.
Tyrone Hayes, Professor of Integrative Biology, University of California, Berkeley.
Imagine that there are species that we haven't even discovered yet that are already gone in my lifetime, in the last week, in the last 24 hours.
Bernard Zelaya, Sierra Club National Board Member and Vice President from 2004 to 2006.
The general public is relatively unaware of the fact that we're in certainly the worst extinction spasm in the last 65 million years, you know, and arguably the worst one in planetary history.
It's really paradoxical that the scientific community is not up in arms and out in the newspapers saying this over and over and over. There's such an important message to be put out for the public from the scientific community that there is this species loss, this loss in diversity that is massive and will have very serious consequences.
We don't want to scare people off, and we don't want to suggest that the end of the world is unavoidable. It's a great problem, but it's also a great challenge, a great creative challenge, and a great opportunity, because we can still fix this. Some people say, well, if we lost several dozen species yesterday, but the sun still came up on time this morning and the newspapers are out on the street, does it really matter?
Gretchen Daly.
Human well-being is intimately linked to the well-being of nature and of the plants and animals that make it up. We cannot live without many of these other creatures.
Richard Leakey.
Biodiversity is fundamentally important. to the survival of humanity. I do recognize that the survival of humanity may not necessarily be the most important thing, but we are humans and most of us think that it is important.
Extinctions have profound consequences for humans. We can think of this aesthetically, we can think of it intellectually, and we can also think of it in purely selfish ways, where we have to consider the impact of species extinctions on us.
We depend on many species that we actually directly either eat or use for fuel, for fiber, for fodder for the animals that we eat, and so on. That diversity, let's say agricultural or economically important diversity, is very important, and we are losing that diversity. But beyond the species that we interact directly with as humans, there is a whole group of many more. You multiply that times 10 and times 100 and times 1,000 orders of magnitude as you move out away from the things that we use. And that net of diverse organisms is the net that is necessary to support the organisms that we care about.
There are tremendously important bigger scale services like climate regulation, the nice climate we've had on Earth in the past many thousands of years anyway, is intimately linked to the plant and animal life on the planet. Purifying of water, much of which is done as water filters slowly through the roots of forests and is cleaned by various microbes that help kill off pathogens that could otherwise hurt people.
Peter Vitusek.
Diverse organisms out there contain biochemicals and genes that are useful for our agricultural systems and will increasingly be useful for our pharmaceutical systems. Already they make a dominant contribution to our medications, but the diversity of genes that are out there, the diversity of biochemicals, really underpin a lot of our agricultural and medical enterprises.
Brock Dolman, biologist, the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center.
There's the classic story of Lyme's disease from Lyme, Connecticut. It's a disease that people get from ticks. It's a spirochete that is in the saliva of ticks. What was being looked at is, why is there more Lyme's disease in the human population in the Northeast than the West Coast? What they found is that the life cycle of the tick in the Northeast was always on mammals, mice and deer and people. But out here in the West, it would run through a blue-belly lizard or an alligator lizard, and it turned out that when the tick bites the lizard, something in the blood kills that spirochete, and thus is biofiltering via lizard blood the presence of this disease-causing organism and reducing the infection rate in the human population.
Gretchen Daly.
Of the top 150 prescription drugs currently on the market in the U.S., about 120 owe their origin to natural products, mostly to plants. Plants have very good chemical defenses that we use in tiny doses in defense of the microorganisms that attack us.
Richard Leakey.
The genetic bank, the gene bank in the wild, particularly in agriculture and other areas, is enormous. And we simply can't squander what we may need for our own future if we want to be purely selfish.
Populations. Paul Ehrlich, president of the Center for Conservation Biology, Stanford University.
The extinction problem is not just a problem of loss of species, it's a problem also of loss of populations, because it's the populations that deliver the ecosystem services. If there's one population of honeybees alive in Italy and they're extinct over the rest of the planet, that's not going to help you pollinate your alfalfa in Idaho.
Some people say, well, if a species has 10 different populations and 9 of them get knocked out, that's okay, we've still got the one population left. We would have lost a great deal of the genetic variability that could support our agriculture, our medicines, our raw materials. So really, it's not just a case of endangered or threatened species. It's a case of maintaining the spectacular variety of life in its full panoply.
There's an entirely different dimension to the problem than just let's preserve the bison or the panda or the bald eagle or whatever. These are all part of the same system, and it's all part of preserving our life support systems.
You have this little fish, and let's say it's a Chinook salmon, leaving the stream as a 4 or 6 inch little fish, going to the ocean for 3, 4, 5 years, and they go from a 6 inch fish, weighs some few ounces, to a 50 or 60 pound fish, and then return famously leaping and jumping all the way back up to the headwaters. They spawn, and then they die. And that's the great moment. In their death, it is all of the nutrients that they've accumulated in the oceans that have been literally embodied, and they're brought back to the headwaters of the watershed. We're talking calcium, phosphorus, nitrogen, potassium, the very building blocks, the elemental building blocks of every biologic process. Scientists have found 60% of the nitrogen in a needle of a conifer along a stream in Oregon is of marine origin isotopically. They studied grizzly bear bones taken out of Yellowstone National Park, 1,500 miles from the ocean, found 50% of the calcium isotopically was of marine origin. So we're talking half of the primary nutrients for a watershed were being brought back on an annual cycle, millions of pounds every year in the dead bodies of these fish that eagles and ospreys and otters and bears and native people would eat and then transport through the watershed. So the extinction of salmon in the Pacific Northwest isn't just the loss of a totem species, it's also the loss of the fertility upon which healthy forests and grassland ecosystems depend.
Cascade and collapse. Stuart Pym.
Nature is an intricate web. When you take a piece out and other things follow as a consequence. We have the issue of what we call extinction cascades. Like a house of cards, you take one card out, maybe it's okay. You take another card out, and maybe the whole structure will fall apart.
Paul Ehrlich.
One important thing to remember about environmental processes is that they're often nonlinear. A linear process is where if you push twice as hard on something, it goes twice as far or twice as fast. But in fact, you often can go over thresholds, and if you push twice as hard, it'll go 100 times as fast. There can be irreversibilities, discontinuities, where instead of going steadily in one direction, all of a sudden everything collapses and so on. And that's what really concerns scientists, because all of our thinking tends to be projecting as if things are linear. But we know from history that things are not linear.
Peter Rupnerin.
The network of interrelationships is very complicated. There can be surprises hidden in there. Ecosystems can be very robust to some sorts of changes, and they can be extremely fragile to some sorts of changes, and that leads to this notion of extinction cascades and collapses.
Many different organisms are necessary for the top feeding levels to survive. So when you lose diversity in those lower levels, you're putting your large-scale organisms at risk.
The possibility that you could set in motion a substantial cascade resulting from the extinction of a single species is always there.
Biodiversity really is a tapestry of life. Each species is somewhat like a thread that weaves into the tapestry, and it's the whole entire tapestry that's at stake here.
Orrin Lyons of the Turtle Clan, Onondaga Nation, professor of SUNY, Buffalo.
The elimination of a species affects everything and affects everybody and affects the whole earth itself. So the web of life is what we know about. And we know how important it is for every aspect of that to be sustained and protected for the betterment of everything. But the health of the earth itself is all predicated on how healthy all strands of that web are.
Ignacio Capella.
For a microbial ecologist like myself, the mass extinction that we're going through really takes on a very different proportion. The massiveness of it, I think, becomes so much more daunting. People call it species extinction, but it's more than the species themselves. It's really the diversity within species and beyond species. Whole families could be going extinct.
It's not just a quantitative question. It's not a numerical issue of simply counting how many species are in a place. It's the qualitative relationship between those species that breeds a resiliency that really gets into ecology of relationship. In the absence of biodiversity that has its fabric held together, we run the risk of a failing or fragmented future.
Without biological diversity, without unique organisms, communities, and ecosystems in different parts of the world becomes a very homogeneous and uninteresting and impoverished place.
Many people have this vision that we can live in a microbial world, for example, by growing microscopic algae on vats and eating that. I don't want that. Can we live off that? Yes. Do we want to live off that? I say no.
Norman Myers.
I am appalled at the thought that somewhere down the line we might have to say, well, the tiger was a very lovely creature, but the Monday morning world said there wasn't space for the tiger in our world. It's a dreadful thought.
Mary Evelyn Tucker from the Forum on Religion and Ecology, Yale University.
Anyone who has children and anticipates having grandchildren has got to say what will be left for them.
Reuben Goldberg.
Personally, I want to see a lot of plants and animals, but like if they're not there, then I won't be able to. I'll only be able to see pictures, not in real life.
Tyrone Hayes.
I want to be able to take my son and my daughter out to the pond and have them see the amphibians and the dragonflies and the garter snakes that are eating the amphibians, etc. But also, being able to do that is a sign that we still have a healthy planet, that this diversity of life that has evolved, or if you believe differently, that has been created, is a sign that things are as they were meant to be, so to speak, whether you're looking at that from a scientific perspective or from a more heartfelt perspective. It's a sign of a healthy environment.
Reverend Sally Bingham, President of the Regeneration Project and Interfaith Power and Light.
What are our values and what's our obligation as human beings in terms of the role that God put us in? When we see species dying at the rate that I understand they are, it's very scary, and it calls into question, what does it mean to be human today?
Mariana Vale, doctoral candidate in ecology, Duke University.
As a biology student in Brazil, I started just working with mammals and doing inventories in different areas, and I had the experience of going through kilometers and kilometers looking for a forest where we could do our work, and I realized that even if you're just interested in research, we're soon not going to have places to do research. Biology is going to be restricted to molecular biology because there is nothing else out there to be looked at. Before we even understand and we know the species that we have and the beautiful fauna that we have, we're not going to have it anymore.
The drivers of extinction and the six icons: habitat loss, invasive species, overexploitation, global warming, pollution, and in the center, overpopulation.
The last recorded truly mass extinction was about 65 million years ago, and we're now starting into another mass extinction, except this time it's not an asteroid, it's our own species, Homo sapiens, that's doing the job.
Global change being brought on by the way we live and the size of the human population today is not unlike the impact of an asteroid. The difference is we know we're doing it, we can measure the size of the impact that we're creating, and yet we still find it very difficult to do anything about.
Mary Evelyn Tucker.
I think human consciousness cannot yet take this in, because if we are extinguishing that which has brought us into being, what does it mean about our own human nature?
It's definitely being pushed by human activities, by changes in habitat,
by moving species around and introducing them into ecosystems, causing native species to go extinct, by over-exploitation. And now we're starting to see some of the first extinctions due to global warming. All of those definitely trace back to human activities and the scale of those human activities.
The loss of biodiversity, I think there are many reasons. There's no the cause. We've done more than one thing to the environment.
There's been a combat between the animal world and the human being. And the animal world always suffers because the human is probably the fiercest and most capable of all predators.
Conversely, we are the only species that has ever lived that has the power to save other species. On the one hand, we destroy them. On the other hand, we safeguard them.
I think habitat loss is, if you want one single answer, is probably the most important. Of course, there are many factors that affect this. The spreading out of cities, the spreading out of agricultural fields, the spreading out of roads, and the consequences of road building all over the world are having really dramatic consequences.
There is not a pristine, that is, non-human interfered with ecosystem on the planet.
Somewhere in the vicinity of maybe 70% of the Earth's surface has become transformed for human goods and services.
At the most, the present network of reserves that we've got planet-wide that cover about 10% of the land's surface will protect over the long run roughly 5% of the plants and animals that we share the planet with today. These places are just too disconnected.
If we look at amphibians, more than 50% are endangered or threatened. There is now a global decline in amphibians. There are a lot of interacting causes, and that's the focus of my research now, is how do pesticides integrate with global climate change and loss of habitat and invasive species. And we're finding over and over again that pesticides are intricately involved in adverse effects on amphibians. And to me, that's a mirror for what's happening in general.
The easiest place to see pollution-causing population losses is to look at all the dead lakes and dead rivers around the planet and the dead zones now off of the mouths of rivers.
Nitrogen fertilizer is essential to the maintenance of our present human population. But that nitrogen moves around the planet to places where we don't mean to apply it. It over-enriches places, turns clear lakes into pond scum, clear coastal oceans into estuaries full of algal blooms that are harmful to fish, and so change the way the world works in ways that are unpleasant to us, but fatal to many of the other species with whom we share the planet.
Derek Jensen, author and activist.
There is no such thing as waste in the natural world. Plastic was invented, and something really extraordinary happened, which is, for the first time ever, humans created something that had never been eaten by someone before. That's a problem, because nobody knows how to eat it, and so it accumulates.
Stuart Pym.
We're also extremely careless about moving species around the world. We have introduced species to all sorts of places where they do not belong, and when they get there, they do harm.
African grasses have been spread to much of the world's tropics, have invaded South America, Australia, and the islands of the Pacific, and have really changed the way those systems function.
Peter Vitusek.
Lakes and streams in North America are dramatically altered, not just in the number of species, but composition and even function of those systems by the introduction of species from outside of North America. And that happens over and over around the world.
Stephen Beisinger, Professor of Conservation Biology, University of California, Berkeley.
We're seeing changes in the percentage of CO2, carbon dioxide, in the atmosphere. at scales that we just didn't think were possible for people to transform.
The emissions of the combustion of carbon in the atmosphere that is going to push our ecosystems on top of the habitat destruction forward into a level where those that lack resiliency because of the extinctions that have occurred there or the disruption of the processes, the lifeboat that you're dependent on is beginning to spring holes and take on water at a level that we won't be able to bail ourselves out of.
Global change, global warming, I would liken to an approaching slow-moving tsunami. We are going to be engulfed by changes that will make it very difficult for us to sustain life as we have known it through the current and historical periods.
Global warming alone could doom more than a million species by 2050. Over-exploitation.
The human enterprise has grown in ways no one anticipated, and we're now an absolutely stunning global force on the planet. And there's this real tension in our quest to live a good life. We're wiping out the very foundations of our well-being.
The 6 billion of us already consume half of all the annual supply of green stuff for our crops, for our animals, for the wood that we need. We are eating half the planet every year. We use half of the world's available fresh water supply. We use a third of what the oceans do for us. That's with 6 billion people. We know the population is going to grow to at least 9 billion people by mid-century.
When I was growing up, it didn't seem possible that fish in the sea could be harvested at such a rate that the populations would decline so greatly. Now we have closed seasons. Now we have harvest restrictions on many commercial species because we have so many mouths to feed.
There are now 400 million people in China who are fairly affluent and are middle class. They want meat like never before, meat once a day at least instead of once a week at most. Most of their meat is grain-fed, raised on soybeans. Where do they get the soybeans from? From Brazil. The Brazilians are growing soybean plantations to meet this enormous demand from China, and that's contributing to destruction of wildlife habitats in Brazil.
The actual environmental consequences of our resource use, we don't even see it. Rainforest being cut down in Indonesia, it becomes an abstraction. Most Americans have never been to Indonesia or Amazonia. They've heard about mowing down the rainforest, but it's not a personal experience, and it tends to put a distance between them and the actual consequences of their personal lifestyles. If you're destroying biodiversity and its habitat in order to grow date palms for biodiesel, you're certainly still contributing to the extinction crisis.
Overpopulation.
When I was a young man of 20 years old, which was in 1950, there were 2.5 billion people in the world. Today, we now have 6.6 billion people in the world within 57 years. It took millions of years to come to that 2.5 billion, and then within 57 years, we've doubled the population. That's not sustainable.
Richard Leakey.
It has been politically incorrect to say that the human population is too large. People say, well, we must stabilize it. It's far more serious than stabilizing. We must reduce it. How do you decide which part of the population should be reduced? Which countries should have what numbers of people? How do you decide what the resources should be for these people as opposed to those people? These are very, very politically sensitive and complex issues, and I don't have an answer. But I do know that we must find an answer, and we need to start talking about these things.
The United States is one of the fastest growing countries in the world, and yet the Sierra Club does not dedicate any resources at all to a domestic population program. our donors are happy to have us work for family planning assistance to the third world, but we haven't found any donors that want to fund domestic work, and we haven't chosen to take our due revenues from our members and place it into that kind of an effort.
Paul Ehrlich.
Nobody knows exactly what the Earth's carrying capacity is. Temporarily, obviously, we can keep over 6 billion people alive in some state, but you can also see that the cost of that is continual deterioration of the planet, of our resource base, and in many respects, of our lifestyles. So nobody knows, again, what the ultimate carrying capacity would be, but everybody who's looked seriously at it knows that it's well below where we are now.
Now, I feel compelled to take the unusual step of interrupting this film, perhaps to stave off criticism and say, yes, in keeping with unwelcome guest tradition, I'm attempting to present media in their entirety and not to lose their message, but I'm aware that this is rather opinionated. As somebody who lives in a so-called underdeveloped country, where people are so undeveloped that they consume a tiny fraction of the resources of people in the US, I feel compelled to inject the suggestion that there are two sides to this coin. If somebody came to you and said, your family is overpopulated, there's 6 members in it, please choose 5 of them to die so that one can live in the style to which they are accustomed, I suggest your reaction would be some kind of shock and horror, and possibly the suggestion that all 6 could live and consume 1/6 of the resources. If that seems an impossibility, reflect that Bangladeshis have at least an order of magnitude less per head consumption. So to talk about the world being overpopulated is to take as a given high levels of material consumption that, as the film goes on to explain, don't actually bring people happiness. Now, with that note of caution, let's continue with the film. The Hidden Drivers.
During the last 50 years while I've been involved in conservation, I've noticed that the amount of money going into conservation has increased, let's say, 5 times over. And the amount of scientific understanding we've got has increased 5 times over. The number of citizens involved in this game increased 5 times over. And yet, our cause is still going down the tubes. The mass extinction is gathering pace more than ever. So what's going wrong? We need to attack the root causes of our problems.
It's not so much that we're ignoring nature, it's we thinking we can control it and command it in a way that we haven't been able to in the past. And it's that arrogance, I think, that's really going to continue to get us into trouble.
One of the reasons that North Africa was deforested is for the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. And if you don't care about deforesting where you live, you can make a better navy because you can cut more of the trees. But if you're planning on living there for 500 years, you can't cut as many trees. One of the reasons is culture can accomplish the amazing things that it can is because it's consuming and not giving anything back.
Right now, we're in a situation with the rise of globalization that the corporations and corporate capitalism is stronger than it's ever been before, and it's extremely difficult to get into the mainstream media any kind of an intelligent discussion about the pros and cons, and especially about the cons of corporate capitalism.
An American family with 2 children effectively has more like 15 or 20 children when compared with people in Ethiopia or Bolivia.
The Sierra Club, like many environmental groups, tends to have as its members relatively prosperous, educated Caucasian members. And pointing at their consumption choices is something that I think there was always a certain discomfort with doing it. The notion that we can get to the brighter environmental future where the extinction crisis is over and we're not warming the planet anymore, you can't get there ever if you continue ignoring 2/3 of the problem, population and affluence.
This question is so difficult for the developed world because the human community has emerged for the first time in the 20th century to very high standards of living for many, many people. The abundance is so comfortable, it's so seductive, it brings us into a sense of pleasure and entertainment, and we want to luxuriate in luxuries. That's human nature. And believe me, it's emerging around the planet. Everywhere, this sense of a luxury economy is present.
The corporate interests in America have a real desire to have their customers to feel free to go about business as usual. And the environmental movement in general and the Sierra Club do not try to counterbalance that corporate message, because frankly, that's not an effective use of our very scarce resources.
This model of the economy that has to grow has to stop. There is no such thing as never-ending growth.
Capitalism is intrinsically, ecologically illiterate in its current expression because it's based on this ever-expanding growth model that does something what economists call externalization of costs. Thickening atmosphere, CO2 increasing levels, rising seas, melting glaciers, species extinctions, cancer clusters, those are all actual yields of our economic system. They just don't have a line item on the budget.
The belief that you can have an economic system based on infinite growth on a finite planet is one of the things that's killing the planet. That's one of the reasons this culture has been destructive from the beginning, is it's been based on consuming one's land base and expanding and moving on. John Muir wrote this line about how it takes nature thousands of years to grow a tree, but any fool can cut it down in an hour or something. And he's wrong. It takes a lot of fools to cut down a tree. It takes an entire culture. I mean, try cutting down a redwood tree by yourself without a saw that was made in Taiwan. And why would you cut down a redwood tree if you couldn't sell it into the global marketplace?
One of the key psychological assumptions at the heart of corporate capitalism is that we're primarily self-interested. We're selfish people. That's the essence of our motivation. Most of our clinical and developmental theories assert that as we mature psychologically, we become less selfish and more concerned about others and about society. And that most forms of psychopathology include over-concern with our own desires and needs.
The interesting thing is that although our society, our economy, appears to be driven on the basis of consumption, there's a mass of data, a lot of it collected by economists, which shows that once your basic human needs are taken care of, your happiness is not related to your consumption. If you check out happiness in the United States, for example, or satisfaction, it is essentially unchanged or declined in the last 40 or 50 years, during which time our consumption has absolutely skyrocketed.
Alex Kanner, co-author of Psychology and Consumer Culture.
I think we all secretly think, well, if I could just double my salary or the amount of money I make, I'd be a lot happier. All this financial pressure would be off of me. I could get several things that really matter, and I'd be in much better shape. But people who are making $10,000 a year are thinking that, and people who are making $1 million a year are thinking that. So this is the consumer fallacy, that if I just had more, I would be happy.
A lot of people are now starting to say, we're buying economic advance at the cost of a retreat in human welfare. Nobody ever said on their deathbed, gee, I wish I'd earned more money so that I could have consumed more. We want something greater than that for our last breath.
The techno fix.
The domination of the planet by humans is obviously a direct byproduct of our evolutionary success, which was the ability to use our brain and our manipulative hands in our technology and with our technology to fundamentally alter the way we impact on our environment. This is something that's been going on for a long time. It is our technology that has given this position of dominance, but it's not a very secure dominance. And I think we've misled ourselves slightly in believing we had the handle on our own future.
At this point, by the estimates of energy specialists, we would need about 5 planet Earths, simply from the point of view of energy, to keep going the way we are. And to deny that by thinking that we're going to come up with some techno fix is a very important danger, maybe not for us, but for our children and their children.
For us as humans, and for me as a scientist, to think that somehow I have the knowledge that I can fix this is complete arrogance and completely wrong. And this is the problem when we wantonly do things that start upsetting that balance, thinking that somehow we can fix it with something else.
The economic system is perceived as more important than the planet. If you look at all the so-called solutions to global warming, what you see is they all take industrial capitalism as a given. People say, gosh, how can we stop global warming? What they really mean is, gosh, how can we stop global warming and still have an industrial economy?
The thing that we never bring into our accounting are ecological services and ecological resources. Economists call that externalities. And every wave of technological development that we've been through has required more and more of that network of support. So it is dangerous in that sense because it doesn't come free. Every new proposal for a technofix requires some cost, some investment of something.
People talk about having this solar economy. Where are you going to get the copper for the wiring? Where are you going to get any of the metals? You need mines. Okay, how are you going to transport them? That means that you need a transportation system, the whole oil infrastructure, or the hydroelectric infrastructure, or whatever. But the point is, you can't have ice without a refrigeration system. And you can't have a refrigeration system without metals. You can't have metals without mining. You can't have mining without mine wastes. And it's really easy for people to forget that.
The danger of the technofix is a very treacherous one because we are exposing our descendants for our benefit and not taking responsibility for what we have done and our ancestors have done. We simply keep passing on the ball as in a pyramid scheme to future generations. I think the general public is aware that there are problems with the technologies that we're putting out in the environment today. And also the public is aware that we're not asking the right questions, that we're not coming up with a dispassionate and objective analysis of the situation, that we seem to be feeding into the denial of our culture.
Denial.
We do have a culture of avoidance and denial, and we want to engage in the pleasures of today, and tomorrow's another story.
Alex Kanner.
Denial is a word that actually refers to quite a few different processes. And our denial of the environmental damage that we're doing probably includes all of these different processes in one way or another. I know many times when I was initially reading about extinction, I would hear these overwhelming statistics, you know, 3 to 10 species going extinct every day. I would feel my stomach turning, or I would feel depressed. And I would read on, and probably within an hour or so, completely forgotten about it. I didn't know how to wrap my mind around these overwhelming statistics.
Mary Gomez, professor of psychology at Sonoma State University.
What we're talking about here with extinction is a kind of unraveling of the fabric of life. Just the shock of that, you know, the sense of there's something going on here that's so potentially threatening to my sense of well-being that I have to shut it out in some way.
Alex Kanner.
I don't really think we're running around in denial in the sense of not knowing what's going on or not caring about what's going on. But we are running around in terms of dissociating from what we know and what we feel. Most people really do care about the environment. They care about what's happening to the Earth. It makes them sad, unhappy, angry. And yet we go about our lives as if this wasn't happening. So our actions are split off from what we know and what we feel.
It's beyond anything that humans have had to face ever before. And so the magnitude of what we're trying to do in terms of getting past this denial is quite large. When you think about it, what does our culture offer us in the way of wisdom to deal with any kind of difficulty? Our cultural wisdom is, buy this, it'll make you happy.
Our society helps our denial, helps our dissociation. It encourages it. It even structures it into the way that the whole society operates. The media is continually telling us that in order to be happy, we need to consume. It's almost un-American not to want to participate in this mad rush to own more and more things. We know that we're consuming and it's destroying the environment, so we split off what we know about the environment when we're in the store.
In order to maintain our way of living, we must tell lies to each other, and especially to ourselves. And it's not necessary that lies be particularly believable, but merely that they be erected as barriers to truth. If space aliens were doing what this culture is doing, if aliens came down from outer space and they were vacuuming the oceans, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, 90%. If they were changing our genetic structure with phthalates and they were changing the climate, we would fight back.
When you have loudspeakers out there, the megaphone from the polluting corporate interests that are out there being able to say, don't worry, there is no problem. There's some alarmists out there that might be trying to mislead you, but there really is no problem. Who are you going to want to believe? The person that's telling you, no problem, don't worry about it, or the person that says, this is the worst problem the planet has ever faced. You might actually have to engage in some introspection upon how you live your life.
We have the illusion or delusion that we're not dependent on nature. We live in a world that's mostly human built. We live in buildings that are sealed shut. In urban and suburban settings, the natural gets pushed further and further away. And so we live, in a sense, encased in a human fantasy of what life is.
A lot of people say that cities are places of sensory overload. It's actually the opposite. It's a place of sensory deprivation, because every sound, every smell, every sight is either originating in or mediated by human beings. And so you're basically living in an echo chamber. You don't get these reality checks of non-humans to tell you that there are others and to make you sane. We live day to day surrounded. I mean, right now, how many machines are within 10 yards of us? How many machines do you have a daily relationship with? How many wild animals do you have a daily relationship with? It's no wonder we don't defend the places we live. We don't live there. That's insane. If insanity means being out of touch with physical reality, we don't even need to use a pejorative definition of insanity.
No way. We have whole generations at this point that lack access and understanding and relationship to the living world. This new study, nature deficit disorder, is a really fascinating conundrum for people. Why care about something if I have no relationship to it, and if I can't put a name on it, I don't have a connection?
Where does your food come from? If your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from the tap, you will defend to the death the system that brings those to you, because your life depends on it. Not philosophy, not what you believe in your heart, but your experience. If, on the other hand, your experience is that your food comes from a land base and that your water comes from a river, then you will defend to the death that land base and that river, because your life depends on it.
Joanna Macy, teacher, author, and activist.
The industrial growth society makes it very easy for us to stay in denial, because it conveys to us a self-image of being a very small and a very needy kind of being. We are actually prey to a late capitalist economic system that has been for generations consistently breeding a kind of self-loathing, a kind of self-deprecation.
Like any good abusive system, this system has made us dependent upon it for our very lives, which means we can only fight it half-heartedly. And that's one of the things that happens all the time with abusive family dynamics. Let's say that a man is abusive to his wife. One of the things he will do is make her dependent, economically, socially, self-esteem-wise, upon him. Because otherwise, she's not going to put up with it. It's the same. We have been made dependent upon this very system that's exploiting us. And that makes it much, much, much more difficult to fight.
Politics. Paul Ehrlich.
There is an enormous gap between what the academic community knows needs to be done if we're going to have a decent world for our grandchildren and what the public understands, and more than that, what the politicians are willing to do. The average politician always wants more consumption, thinks that's the way to keep the economy growing, and it's sort of like trying to find some way to keep your cancer growing.
Bernard Zelaya.
We know that the best scientists in the world have been telling us for a long time that this is, in fact, the worst crisis this planet has ever faced. And so there truly is a disconnect between that fact and the fact that environmental organizations who the public look to for information aren't hearing that message. This can lead people to wonder, you know, if they're not hearing from the Sierra Club, which is one of the organizations in this country that people look to for good information about what's really going on, well, then it must not really be an issue. The Sierra Club and other environmental groups tends to not invest resources in educating the public about the extinction crisis because it isn't perceived to get much political bang for the buck.
Ignacio Capella.
More and more as the years go by, the important questions in biology are bad news. And it's very hard to bring bad news because people don't like the bad news. So there is a very strong drive for scientists not to even work on this topic unless they're somehow protected within the scientific community. We say there is one question, one career. You dare ask one question and find the answer and make it public, and your career is shot. So it doesn't take too many of these examples for scientists to learn, to recognize that there is a risk in being outspoken about the problems.
There's a risk with your academic colleagues to speaking out. When I originally got involved in this, I sort of naively thought that science was the total answer. I thought that if I presented good science to industry, that they would do the right thing, that they would alter their practices so that they would reduce harm to the environment and to people.
Even though we can remove pollution downstream, clean up a watershed, we can create new laws for greater equity in education or healthcare, but ultimately those are just helping the symptoms. Until we address our way of thinking and our whole framework and orientation, we're going to continue to make mistakes.
The flaw.
It is really very difficult, in my experience, to persuade people that something that may happen in 50 years' time, or the full result of which will be known in 50 years' time, is something they should worry about today. This is extraordinarily short-sighted and extraordinarily foolish, and is a complete contradiction of the idea that it was human intelligence that made us successful. We do not use the very evolutionary attribute that brought us to where we are.
Melissa Nelson, Professor of American Indian Studies, San Francisco State University.
All of the problems we see in our outer environment, whether it's racism, classism, poverty, starvation, now environmental destruction,